Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Hey, Thriving Farmers, Michael Kilpatrick here with you, another episode of the Thriving Farmer Podcast. And today my guest is Cole Mazariegos Anastasio, who is a farmer, and you guys farm a pretty wide range of crops, is that correct?
Yes, we do between about 40 or 50 crops on about 30 acres in Pescadero, California.
Okay, now give us a little bit of a background of like the farm, like where exactly is it in California?
Yeah, definitely. So we're located in the town of Pescadero. It's a small town of about 600 people. It's in a rural area that's just outside of the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area. So we're about an hour and a half from San Francisco, give or take. It's a really nice climate because we're right along the California coast, central coast. So we can grow a pretty wide range of crops where we can grow, you know, lettuce and salad mix year round. We can also grow crops that are warmer weather, like tomatoes, peppers, eggplant. And so for us, I think for our model in particular, with us, we're such a wide range of crops to supply a lot of local businesses and sort of become our own distributor, for lack of a better word, in terms of sort of mimicking what some distributors do. It works very well for us because we can grow such a good range of things.
Okay. And then how many acres of vegetables is that?
It's 30 acres. Yeah. So we actually have more acreage in total, but about 30 acres actively of vegetable production.
Okay. And then what's the breakdown? Is there a specific crops that you do a lot of and then supplement with smaller other ones?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I'd say our main crops tend to be winter squash, pumpkins, potatoes, tomatoes, a lot of lettuce, salad mix, cabbage, peppers, and eggplant. We do smaller quantities of a lot of additional crops, strawberries, cucumber, summer squash, dry beans. There's a pretty long list of them. It'd be too long to list here.
Yeah.
But I'd say those are the bigger ones that we do in larger volumes. And most of our sales, about 95% of what we grow is for wholesale use. So sending it out, not to distributors for the most part, but going out directly to businesses throughout the greater Bay Area, along with other parts of kind of Northern California. And a lot of those sales tend to be, you know, very large volumes of certain products. Some of the products that we grow large volumes of, like potatoes or pumpkins, we have contracts with for certain buyers for pretty large volumes. So it varies a little bit. Where our goal with what we do is really to become an alternative to a produce distributor, where a lot of our buyers can work with us to get most of the things that they want to get as far as produce goes. At least of what can be grown in our area.
Okay, so then talk to me a little about distribution. Is that something that's gone out with like straight trucks, like refrigerated straight trucks, or how do you do that all delivery?
Yeah, refrigerated trucks. We use a refrigerated Sprinter and a refrigerated box truck, and for us, having the combination is helpful because you know some of our buyers can be, you know, larger warehouses where you can really only go in with a box truck. Some of them tend to be smaller. Grocery stores in San Francisco where it's pretty tough to go in the box truck. It's really better with the Sprinter. So we're doing all of our own distribution.
Very cool.
And we can go as far as Sacramento, which is about three and a half hours away, give or take.
Okay. And so how have you built a brand? Because obviously there's a lot of options in California for folks. So how have you built a brand that means people are coming to you?
Yeah, good question. I think for us, when we started our farm originally back in 2018, we really wanted to kind of focus on having this be our particular model for a couple of different reasons. I think there's a lot of great farms that do a lot of direct-to-consumer, whether it's farmers markets or CSA. There's a lot of great farms that also work with restaurants, especially a lot of like higher-end restaurants. What we've noticed is sort of just a gap that I think is an important gap because it's where a lot of people eat in the food system is more purchases from grocery stores is part of it, but it's also things like school districts, universities, hospitals, corporate kitchens. There's a wide range of different types of buyers that I think typically don't get as much attention from small local farms. And so from us, what we really have done is built out our systems in some respects, kind of mimicking or replicating some of the things that larger distributors do. So, I think when we originally created our systems for sending out price sheets,
for example, a lot of that was examining, not so much what other farmers do, but examining more like what would an organic produce distributor do? And, creating systems kind of around that.
Okay. So then I'm assuming a lot of this is demand driven. So you're not going to harvest until mm-hmm. the orders come in. So do you want to walk us through like Typically, what a week yeah. on the farm looks like?
Yeah. It varies a little bit year to year in terms of our time of year.
Season.
Month to month, that is, based on the season. But we grow year round. We obviously do a little bit less in the wintertime compared to the main season. But for us, typically, we are doing two main harvests per week, kind of two main harvest periods. And so we usually have like a two-day window harvest period between Tuesday and Wednesday for stuff that's being mm-hmm. sent out for the most part on Thursday, with some of it being sent out on Friday. And then we have another harvest window of Friday and Saturday. That's things being sent out on Sunday and Monday. And so we kind of break our week into two sections, more or less. Pretty much everything we harvest is something we have a sale for already, almost exclusively. So we have very little waste. It's pretty rare that we harvest something and then just have to toss it in the compost pile because we don't have an outlet for it. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so then the orders come in, and then do you have a custom software, or what software are you using for those orders to come in with?
Good question. So we've looked at a lot of softwares. We looked at them a number of years ago, and I understand there's some, I think it's been some growth to some of the software. So we actually are looking into a local food marketplace is one we may transfer into now. Up to this point, though, we've created our own softwares, because I think back when we looked at them, we really couldn't figure out something that worked for us in terms of being all encompassing. So let me rephrase that. We didn't create our own software. What we just use is a really elaborate system of Google Sheets that we basically use for receiving orders. I found that a lot of the buyers we work with are pretty old school in the sense that a lot of them wouldn't necessarily want to receive or want to place orders on a website. A lot of them have their own systems. A lot of them just want to give you a phone call. A lot of them may text you. I've even worked with some old school grocery buyers that want all the price you sent by fax and then want to fax you back what they have to order. I think especially in the grocery industry, there's a lot of old school things of that nature. And then I think especially some of the other buyers, it's really, phone calls, text especially as well. So from our perspective, the softwares, I think it seems like there's a lot of benefits to them. But I think from our end, having our own system that really encompasses all different types of buyers in terms of the way that they order had made sense for us. So I would say, if there's other farmers that are trying to get into this, there may be really good softwares out there. But I would say for us, what we found was really investing time into creating like an extremely well-organized system for using Google Sheets. We also use that Google Sheets as well for crop planning as well. And for doing, 40 different crops on 30 acres is a pretty complicated crop plan. But we found that like if you really take the time to invest in it, especially during the slower time of year, you can create a really, really robust system that kind of tells you everything you need to know about, crop planning or about harvest lists and so on.
Absolutely. We still actually use, we've played with a few different softwares, but we still use mm-hmm. Google Sheets for all our crop planning in the greenhouse, the nursery business, as well as the fields. So talk me through a little bit of, with that the climate where you can grow year round, what does your soil fertility look like on the farm?
Yeah, good question. So for us, we utilize cover cropping and we utilize composting as our two main sources of fertility. So essentially all the land that we grow on, we cover crop once per year at least. And so we'll kind of rotate around the sections that we cover crop based on what we're growing in the wintertime. Most of the fields are cover cropped over the wintertime though. It's just the easiest time of year to do it. For reasons of rain and so on in our climate. So from a fertility plan, it's really based on building soil. I think that's one area that we've really focused on, trying to differentiate ourselves from some of the other farms that may be organic but maybe aren't utilizing those soil-based practices. I think in the wholesale space in particular, it's challenging to differentiate yourself because you don't necessarily have a easy certification you can point to or just like, hey, I'm organic versus conventional. At a farmer's market, it's usually a little bit easier to take the time with customers to explain what the difference is. We recently we're certified with Real Organic Project, which is kind of an extension of organic certification that kind of shows the additional certification in terms of showing your soil based, you're growing with practices of building your soil. That's really your focus. And so I think that's been an important distinction for us to make with some of our buyers in particular. It's been kind of an added benefit.
But I would say from our perspective, I think for our own personal reasons more than anything else, we really want to focus on building soils, utilizing cover cropping and composting as the main sources of fertility, and then kind of figuring out how we can recapture some of the differentiation, in those practices versus some other larger scale organic, but maybe not as soil focused farms.
Okay. So then you went real organic certified. What were the, mm-hmm. what was the additional things that you had to do, or was it no changes at all to get that certification?
It's a good question for us. It was really not anything different than our current CCUF certification, which is our main organic certifier.
Uh-huh.
Well, you do have to have a certification from a CCUF or some other certifier of that nature. It was really more after that point, you then have a conversation with somebody from Real Organic Project that will go and basically spend a little while talking through your practices, your soil practices in particular, and kind of talking about what is your fertility plan, how are you addressing pest issues, disease issues, and so on. And I think from their perspective, what I found from their certifiers is they're very experienced. They tend to have been, farmers or past farmers. It's really more about like them understanding that you actually have thought about this and you have a plan of how to address these issues from a soil focused perspective.
Yes.
Once you've had that conversation, there's really nothing additional to the certification process than that. It's a lot less burdensome from a paperwork and administrative perspective than like a normal organic certification would be. And so I think from that end as well, it's been a pretty easy process, but I do think it's been a neat process that I'd like to see more farms get into, because I think especially as we get into the wholesale space more as a farming community, we need to be able to differentiate easily, our different practices versus, a very large scale, organic farm that's not using those.
Absolutely. Cause organic is now just another label they slap on.
Of course. Yeah. Definitely.
In so many different ways. So yeah, very cool. Mm-hmm. What would you say is like, do you guys do any like, beneficial habitat or stuff like that in the farm to try mm-hmm. to integrate some of that into the farm?
Yeah, we do. So we do hedgerows. We do various hedgerows. We do some, kind of additional beneficial plantings. We do a lot of brassicas, for example, cabbage being the biggest mm-hmm. one.
Yep.
We also do, kale, for example. We do broccoli, a good amount of broccolini in particular. A variety by the name of BC1611 from Johnny's that I definitely recommend if anybody wants to try it. With that, we always plant sweet alyssum, just as an example that helps, attract some predatory wasps that in turn control aphid populations. That's an example. We do a number of other things as well. We grow small amounts of cilantro and dill. They're not really significant crops for us, but it is important for us to allow a lot of that to go to flower. It attracts pollinators as well.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
So we do a number of different things of that nature.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit more about how you integrate the sweet alyssum. Is that something that you interplant with that, or does it get planted actually in mm-hmm. the row, or?
Yeah, for us, we plant in the greenhouse essentially at the same time as we plant all of our brassica succession plants.
Okay.
We plant it out, basically it'll have its own beds. So typically speaking, our successions of brassicas tend to be about a half acre per succession, and we'll essentially book in the succession with one line of sweet alyssum on one side, one line of sweet alyssum on the other side, one bed of each. So it's an important process for us in terms of managing aphid issues. And I think, going back to us being very soil focused, we have very few pest issues, and I think we have very few disease issues compared to a lot of farms. And
yes.
That's really because we've been so focused on building our soil, utilizing those additional things that attract pollinators, that attract beneficials are other ways that you can kind of control those things too.
Yes. So what would you say is your soil type?
It's a clay loam. So our area in our community of Pescadero, it's mostly a little bit more on the clay side in our area. If you go further south towards the next town south is Davenport, you get sandier soils down that way. But our farm is pretty, I'd say clay loam pretty is a pretty much summarizes what I'd say it is.
And how many inches of annual precipitation do you typically get?
That's a good question. It varies a little bit year to year. Last year we had an El Nino, which tend to happen about every quarter century. The last one that we had prior to that was late Andes, about a quarter century before. And so last year was a lot. I think it was, I don't recall off the top of my head, but it was somewhere around 70 inches. A normal year is considerably less than that, probably about half of that.
Our rains though in our area are very predictable, generally speaking, from a seasonal perspective. So usually, but between about May 10th until, you know, I'd say roughly mid to late October, we get pretty much no rain. You know, maybe a little bit in late September, early October, but very rarely anything after May 10th. We do get a good amount of fog that comes in that brings a little bit of moisture, but nothing in terms of rainfall. And then most of our rains all come basically, generally speaking, you know, starting November, but really even more so like December, January, February, and March. That's kind of more or less our patterns in our area. So it is predictable, which you know, can be a bit stressful in certain years if you do have less rainfall. But fortunately, we have pretty good water resources on our ranch. I'd say, so compared to some other farms within California that have, I think, more stresses in terms of water, we're a little bit luckier in that sense. But it definitely is a positive on the other side in terms of you have predictability in terms of you know, knowing you're not going to have, you know, a big rain typically in August that's going to really affect a certain crop or something like that that you're harvesting.
Absolutely. So that means that irrigation is then just one other thing on the farm that you are doing every mm-hmm. single day or every single week. Okay. So yeah, just talk a little about the irrigation system.
Yeah, definitely. We mostly do overhead irrigation. We do some drip as well. It's sort of kind of our main two systems. Drip is really more for a select number of crops that just do better on that system as opposed to overhead. Overhead is kind of the main system we do. And so we typically do that. It ends up getting, you know, creating good moisture for a lot of the crops that we do. It's definitely helpful. Additionally, for organic production, I think overhead is helpful for certain Brassica family plants in particular, because it knocks off some of the pest that may be on the plants too. So there's other crops that we do, like strawberries, our peppers and our eggplant that we do with drip, but in our tomatoes as well. Some of the tomatoes we dry farm, so that's even less, you know, relevant with that. But that's kind of more or less our system.
Okay. And then is that all coming from deep wells or?
No. For us, we have a good amount of reservoirs on this ranch. So this ranch was historic ranch, you know, really built out in the 1870s as a dairy farm. And kind of over the decades, there's been quite a few reservoirs built on the ranch. We have a lot of surface water accordingly that we're able to just pull from their reservoirs. That's enough to get us through each season. And you know, rainfall each winter kind of refills those. If we had an extended drought, you know, that you have to be a bit more careful with how you manage your water resources, but we have a good amount of water. We have a well on site that's really more for domestic use and for use for our wash station.
Okay. Very cool. So let's talk a little bit more about the some of the crops you're growing too. Because we grow strawberries, but we grow how the system we grow them. So talk a little bit like what your strawberry system looks like on the farm.
Yeah, I mean, first, strawberries are not a huge crop. We do about a half acre of them. So it's not like one of our bigger crops. I think the biggest reason why we don't do a lot of them, even this area is a great climate for strawberries, is because of labor. Labor is a bit of a challenge in our community because we have a lot of housing issues, in particular as a community. So it's tough to find folks who would be able to you know, have enough folks basically to be able to regularly do larger, kind of heavier harvests like strawberries.
Yes.
So for us, you know, we do them on on raised beds under plastic with drip irrigation. We harvest typically 3 times per week, and usually we get pretty good production. Starts in April, but really good production is usually in May, going all the way through late September.
Wow. Okay. What varieties are you typically working with?
Mostly Albion and San Andreas. Albion is probably my personal favorite variety. San Andreas is really nice though as well, because you get a lot of early production, which is great.
And then what does your fertility management look like?
For strawberries, so one of the big things we do with strawberries is to kind of back up before you get to some of the fertility later on. But one of the things that we do is focus on doing crop rotations that are very strategic. And strawberries, of all the different things, we really focus on strategic crop rotations. So usually we're following strawberries after a spot where we planted dry beans there before, sort of have extra fertility. We will often also do a higher rate of compost. So we're usually applying 10 tons per acre for the spot that we're going to have strawberries as well. And once we have that, you have pretty good fertility to kind of kick you off throughout a good chunk of the season. When we feel like we need some additional fertility later on, we're going to be using AgroThrive LFP. It's a product, an organic product, or at least a product that is a good one to do through fertigation. it's one of the few crops that we end up actually applying additional fertilizers for. I mean, strawberries, you really have to, but it, one of the very few crops that we end up having to apply any additional fertilizers for besides, besides just the cover cropping process and composting process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause that is such a long season. Our season's typically 6 weeks, sometimes eight. So you're running months compared to that. So that's. And then I'm assuming, are those all plugs you bring in or in the spring or plants that come over from the year before?
So from us, from strawberries, we purchase plants, from a supplier, you know, about a hour and a half south of us. We mostly do, besides that, for all the rest of our crops, we mostly start doing our greenhouse starts on site. So I'd say probably easily 95% of all of our starts are things that we start on our own. We do a very small amount where we'll purchase them from a nursery. It's usually if we just don't have time to do a certain succession in the greenhouse. But we do all of our own greenhouse starts on site. We find that very important because the quality of the starts, you know, that we get, I think is, you know, you want to start with good quality. And I think it makes a difference, to just have really good ones in your greenhouse. But, pretty much everything we do is from there. And then we plant them out in the field with our transplanter. Yeah. We do some direct sown crops, of course, as well. But I'd say, you know, the vast majority of our acreage is greenhouse starts that we do.
Yeah. And then are you using a mechanical transplanter for planting or what are you using for getting the crop to the ground?
Yep. We use a mechanical transplanter. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The only exceptions, I guess, are things that you can't use with that. Like, tomatoes and peppers, for example, we do by hand, you know, for the once a year planting for those, but otherwise it's all mechanical transplanter. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then let's talk a little bit about the people. So you believe there's two other farmers with you.
Yeah. So it's the three of us. So myself, Cristobal Cruz Hernandez is one of the other, farmers, co-owners, operators. Veronica Macedegos Anastasio is the other one as well, who's my wife as well. So the three of us started our business back in 2018. We were all managing other farms within the area. And, we originally started our farm because I was managing a farm and had some interest from a local bakery to grow some additional winter squash for them to supply their pumpkin pies. And Veronica and I, who were dating back at that time, and then Cristobal, who was a friend of ours from us all working together previously at a farm, we just had a conversation one day and just said, you know, let's lease a little bit of land, and it kind of grew very organically and rapidly from there. Cristobal is a very talented farmer. He's been farming in this area for a long time, about 30 years. He originally grew up in Oaxaca in Mexico. He immigrated out here when he was about 18 years old, in 89, I believe it was, and worked for a long time in a lot of the local kind of larger conventional Brussels sprout and artichoke farms in particular within the region. Actually, the first farm he came to when he arrived in the U.S. was actually the land that we currently lease, which is kind of a cool sort of full circle thing. Yeah. And so he worked for a number of farms for quite a long time. And then we ended up working all together in 2015 and 2016 at another farm as well. And then Veronica, she grew up actually in Miami, Florida. Her parents are from Guatemala and Venezuela respectively. And she was not really as much involved in agriculture growing up. It wasn't as much of an interest for her. She was actually interested in international relations, actually, of all things, kind of growing up. And that kind of led her to doing Peace Corps in West Africa after college. In Peace Corps, she became really involved in sort of a rice farming cooperative in Togo in West Africa. And kind of from there became a lot more interested in farming, ended up doing kind of some other international farming projects, and moved out to Pescadero back in 2016 for her, really to kind of gain more experience within farming, and everything kind of took off from there.
Very cool. Unlock the potential of elderberry farming with Growing Farmers. Elderberries, thriving even on marginal land, offer a lucrative opportunity for profiting off your property. Not just the berries, but also sticks, flowers, and leaves are in demand, diversifying income streams. With low initial investments, the path to a profitable elderberry business is within reach. This resilient crop can be your gateway to tapping into a growing market for health-conscious consumers. Start your elderberry venture today and cultivate success. For more details, visit growelderberry.com. That's growelderberry.com. And then talk about like the crew on the farm. Is that something that's more seasonal or the year-round?
Yeah, it varies a little bit based on each person's role. So it is seasonal for quite a bit of the crew. It's more or less we have the three of us who are kind of the co-owners operators. We all work in the farm full time, so we're in the field with our crew doing everything every day. And then we have three additional full time staff throughout kind of the main season, and then it kind of is part time during the winter time, during other part times of the year. We then have some additional folks who work with us, who work at other farms or they work in sort of other jobs altogether, that will work with us often for 1 or 2 days a week in particular within our area. And so we kind of have this really nice crew of a lot of folks who largely we know from our community, who you know, a lot of whom we've known for quite a long time. And yeah, we're very lucky with a really good crew that we have.
Awesome. And then like the business side, so like the ordering, and obviously mm-hmm. there's that customer care too. Is that one of you three, or do you have mm-hmm. someone that like in the office?
No, that's all us. So we, the three of us, we kind of all do a little bit of everything, but we have certain specialties within that. I tend to okay. do more of the sales and ordering. And then that also, you know, kind of with a lot of the harvest management as well. So that tends to be more my role. I think in terms of some of the other administrative things, that tends to be more Veronica. And we do have one person who works with us part-time, a little bit on the side to help with bookkeeping. And then it's sort of additional ways that we break up our different roles. But yeah, we all do a little bit of everything.
Very cool. So let's talk a little bit about like, what does the future look like? So obviously you started 2018, you've scaled to where you are now. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility for more land? I mean, talk mm-hmm. to us a little bit about like the state of California agriculture in that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think land is a challenge out here. In our community, it's a community that was a very strong community from an agricultural perspective for a long time. Back when this ranch, as I mentioned, which was historic from the 1970s, kind of came about, around that period, late 1800s, early 1900s, our community in particular provided probably the majority of produce for the city of San Francisco. And over the years, kind of over kind of, I guess, early to mid, I guess, all the way to late 1900s, it shifted towards a lot more specialization within doing artichokes, Brussels sprouts, some pumpkins, and a few other crops. As kind of you saw similar trends throughout other parts of the country in specialization for a certain region. And I think a lot of those models have had a tougher time, particularly post-NAFTA, especially with a lot of the pricing changes on things. So that particular model has been kind of not doing quite as well. I think that in the early 2000s, we saw throughout California and our region as well, a lot of focus on kind of smaller organic farms that tended to be focused predominantly on farmers markets and direct-to-consumer models. Some to restaurants as well. And I think what we're hoping to kind of see more so within the kind of California space right now is more farms that are kind of working within this framework of trying to impact the food system by selling directly to businesses and institutions. There's a lot of momentum for that right now, especially going towards school districts, hospitals, and universities, which are kind of some of our major outlets for our produce. In terms of the land aspect in particular, land is a big challenge where we are because of our proximity to the Bay Area and also because of just how beautiful the area is that we live in. There's a lot of folks who come from the Bay Area and have been buying up a lot of the properties in this area. And so there's less of that land that really was historically used for farming is being used for farming today. And I know this is a similar story throughout a lot of other parts of the country. I think from our end, the challenge has been twofold. One has been just, you know, being able to find land that you can lease is a challenge. It's not insurmountable, but it's a challenge. I think the bigger challenge in respects, though, is if you do find land that you can lease, the prices to buy are very challenging because things are really based more on vacation home prices, not on agricultural prices. And accordingly, I think the challenge with that is leasing. If you're leasing it from a landowner who maybe isn't an agriculture, doesn't have that background, they may be a little bit hesitant to make serious investments into their property, the kind of investments that are needed to really build out a farm business, and especially a more diversified farm business that needs some of the additional infrastructure like wash stations and coolers and so on. And so the challenge that a lot of us, I think, in our community have in particular are we can find some land to lease, but then, you know, do we have the tenure on that land where we know we can be there in the long term, where it makes sense for us to invest in that spot? So from our perspective, we're trying to continue to grow. We're trying to have more security within the land that we're on and other lands that we may find in the future. I think that challenge though tends to be true, I think, with a lot of younger farmers. And I think it's usually the challenge that a lot of folks get into farming. And I think the next step that you kind of realize is like, just finding a space to lease and kind of getting your farm established is the first thing. It's like, how do you scale up with making investments that you feel comfortable making, considering that you may not have strong tenure on the land that you're on. So we're hoping to have that become, a bit better. I think separately from that, we're also hoping to have a bit more of a regional approach to farming in the sense that we're currently in the process of sort of building out a regional food hub for our community, and sort of our region in particular, that would be sending out produce to a lot of the same buyers that we currently work with throughout the kind of greater Bay Area, Northern California region. And I think with that, having a bit more viability for farmers being able to grow, to scale up more is an important additional component. Because the trends right now, I think, by and large have been, there's fewer and fewer young people getting into farming, even fewer of them stick around in farming. And I think, the land access piece, the having access to markets piece, especially good markets that pay well, are two of the major barriers right now to really have a very robust agricultural system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you. It is something, we've even faced that. We've been looking for 3 years for additional land, and finally last fall, we're able to pick up some additional acreage. But it's nowhere near as beautiful as where you guys are. I really recommend folks get over to your Instagram and you got literally a freaking lighthouse next to your property. Yeah. It's something else.
We're lucky. And the other thing that's pretty special about our spot too is we're really surrounded almost entirely by state parkland.
Yeah.
So we have Onion Nuevo State Park on one side, which is a really beautiful spot. If folks from California may know about it because it's pretty famous for elephant seals, being the location they kind of come each year, and a lot of folks go to see them. And then we're surrounded also by another state park that's kind of part of the Big Basin State Park Complex, which is kind of a pretty, pretty mountainous area. And so from a just beauty perspective, that's awesome for us. I think additionally, having that sort of ecological system around us is very beneficial as well, because in turn, it allows us to sort of have the banks of biodiversity that allow us to really grow in the way that we do. I think our system of farming would be more challenging in an area that's doesn't really have that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And having that buffer on all sides, and I'm assuming the flat farming ground that you're farming is closer to the water, and then the hills are kind of right behind it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So most of the area in our little particular stretch of the coast is pretty flat for the farmland. Yes. And then you kind of are really right up against the Santa Cruz Mountains on one side and the Pacific Ocean on the other side. And it's a bit different actually as you go north and south. It gets a little bit more hilly right along the coast too. And most of the land is kind of more up on cliffs that are more hilly, but we're lucky that we have a good amount of flat ground right here.
Mm-hmm. And then I was just looking that you actually sell to places like Whole Foods. I'm assuming you have to have GAP certification and all of that for them.
Yeah, definitely. So we do have GAP certification. Yeah. And I know that's, GAP certification has been such a big topic, I think, because there's not a whole lot of small organic farms that have it. It's a very administratively burdensome process. Veronica on our team knows it really well. She essentially went through a whole process of learning about it from her experience in a previous farm she worked at. And she's kind of our wizard as far as dealing with GAP certification and just navigating that system. It is a complicated system, though. It's something that I think is worthwhile if you're trying to get into a lot of accessing a lot of larger buyers in particular, but it has its challenges for sure.
Yeah. And we were GAP certified for a while, and because we were selling to a specific wholesaler, and it's not particularly onerous in the aspect of what they make you do. Most of the challenge is just all the paperwork and the processes you have to follow. So we didn't really have to spend a tremendous amount of money to upgrade things. Cause I was a little afraid about when they walked into our wash and pack, and he's like, nope, this is fine. So, talk through that, because that is something you didn't hit on, is that obviously you're leasing your ground. Do you have your wash and pack facilities on there, or is it offsite or?
We do. Yeah. So our wash and pack is all on site here. It's kind of an older facility that was used, was built out by a Brussels sprout farmer who was here years ago. And so we've kind of adapted it to become functional for us. I think we'd like to make more investments into that facility in terms of just kind of really getting it, you know, state of the art. And I think that's where we're currently hoping to do within the next year or two. Okay. But yeah, everything is on site for us, which is very helpful. I think for as diversified of an operation as we have, it would be challenging to not have wash and pack on site.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The amount of the amount that you're doing a lot of root crops too. There's some beautiful potatoes you guys are doing, all the brassicas. Those are heavy crops. So moving those is a challenge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely so.
Yeah, absolutely. What would you say the biggest challenge in starting your business has been?
It's a good question. You know, it's funny. I think the process of starting our business was something that we, you know, that was, I guess over six or I guess almost 7 years ago now. It was a process that we kind of did step by step. And the first, year or so of our business, we were all still managing other farms and we were kind of doing this on the side. And I think the challenges for us in that sense was we had limited time to obviously do everything on our farm, but also especially the marketing aspect of it. And so I think in some respects, the process of us focusing so much on wholesale with other businesses actually was kind of born out of the fact that we just didn't have time to go to farmers markets. And I think sometimes the challenges like that, I think ended up becoming blessings in disguise for the long term. And I think as we've grown, you know, I think the challenge about land tenure has definitely been a challenge about being able to feel like we can invest in our property. I'd say that's kind of been one of the challenges that I think it's been most notable over the years since. And then I think in terms of just marketing, finding different market, you know, marketing outlets for buyers that maybe aren't as used to looking for or working with smaller farms has been a really fun process. It's definitely been a bit of like a daunting process in the sense that you just have to, you know, make a lot of phone calls. You have to reach out to a lot of places. It took us a number of years to really get the whole array of buyers that we work with. And we're still, you know, obviously finding buyers always and every year we find kind of new outlets in new ways as well.
Yeah. It's really cool that you're able to do some larger, you got enough space to do some larger scale, like the dry beans you're doing, all that, some of those heirloom varieties. That's very cool too.
Yeah, definitely.
And you're in, tell folks about how they can follow you, how they can find out more about your business.
Yeah, definitely. We're on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook. And on Instagram, we're pretty keep things up to date more for the most part. And our website is www.brisaranch.com, spelled B as in boy, R-I-S-A ranch.com. Our Instagram is just at @brisaranch. So I recommend reaching out if, you know, our contact information is on our website as well. If folks have questions, you know, feel free to reach out to us directly as well. I think from our perspective, you know, I say this, you know, in the sense that we welcome questions and people reaching out. I think from our perspective, you know, we'd like to see the farming economy be stronger in general. I think, you know, we don't really see ourselves as competitors to other farms, you know, within our region or elsewhere. I think we see ourselves more as competitors, for lack of a better word, with some of the larger scale distribution chains that maybe are not sourcing from farms like ours. So, you know, the more farms that we see, you know, doing good things and entering this wholesale space that we're in, I think is a good thing from our perspective. So we, you know, we welcome questions. We welcome people reaching out who want to learn more about how this works for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. Is that on one aspect, I feel like the farmer's market scene is a little bit saturated, but there is tremendous amount of opportunity at that next stage up.
I think there's opportunity. I think there's opportunity. I think actually even more so, I think the opportunity grows as more farms enter the space. I think that like in some respects, there haven't been a whole lot of farms within our region that have entered that wholesale space in particular that we're in right now. There's some that have, but it's been kind of few and far between. And I think the first waves of farms that have entered it have kind of been needing to figure out the space, but the challenge is we still can't supply all the produce, you know, that a lot of the buyers are needing to have. And so in order for them to take the time to work with farms like us, they need to be able to work with a wide enough array of farms to have all the products they want to get. So I think it's something that actually is the opposite of competition. I think in some respects, it's the more that you have farms enter that space, the better it is for everybody.
Yeah, it's interesting now that we have an on-farm store, and so we're basically now tasked with making sure we have potatoes 12 months a year. And so it's absolutely true that, you know, a supplier that can give us that long-term availability is so much more valuable to us than someone that's got, you know, 50 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, we just brought in a ton from one of our suppliers, you know, across the state. And that was worth it because that will last us for 3 to 4 months at once. So I absolutely agree with you on that. Is that regional aspect and having that specific, you know, enough mass to build, get the truck full, I guess, is one of the challenges too.
Definitely. Yeah, no, I think it is. And I think especially when you start getting into food hubs, which I think we don't really have, as I mentioned, one in our region yet, although we're working on building that. And Veronica and our team has kind of been the leader as far as us working on that. But I think we've seen some really good examples in other parts of California of food hubs that really benefit, you know, a whole farming community. And I think it really comes from, you know, if you can fill up a truck if with a lot of different farmers products, you know, you can do some pretty cool things in terms of getting that produce into a lot of larger buyers that one farm alone couldn't do.
Absolutely. What would you go back and tell yourself if you could start all over again with your farm?
Yeah. It's a good question. I would say the one thing is sometimes I think with farming, things feel very volatile in the moment. And we've dealt with challenges over the years. The year of the pandemic, you know, our farm was hit by a massive wildfire. And that was in particular, you know, very, very heavy for us to deal with. We've had other challenges over the years as well. And in the moment, you always feel like, oh, this is you know, challenging. This is difficult. But I think, you know, as farmers, I think we all have to be resilient. And I think we often are. And I think that with that in mind, you know, the fear in some respects of do I want to make all the investments and things because am I sure I'm actually going to be around to have that work, I think are worthwhile investments. I think in some respects, you even if you don't have land tenure, even if you don't have, you know, total security on the land that you're on, or security as a business, just because, you know, none of us do, you know, in that sense, it's worth making investments as if you're confident you will. And I think sometimes it's better to operate, you know, not out of a place of fear of, you know, failure or insecurity, but more out of confidence that you can make it work. And therefore, you know, put in the money to make an investment now in something that's going to be, you know, useful for you for years to come.
Very cool. Well, Cole, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate your time and your insight. And yeah, keep up the good work out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate it.
So there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.